WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Maria Leaf, and if you have outdoor plans today, be ready for rain. We're under a flood warning until 8 this morning and a flood watch until 2 o'clock this afternoon. There are a number of roads with high water at this hour. LBD will have a full check of the roads coming up. The Women's March is back in D.C. with a sit-in planned near the White House.
Watch for crowds and road closures near the White House. Ahead of the event, organizers asked potential participants if they'd be willing to risk arrest. The Women's March was last in town on May 14th for the Bans Off Our Bodies rally after a draft Supreme Court opinion overturning Roe v. Wade was leaked. Now that the ruling is setting off trigger laws in some states, organizers say their message to President Biden is clear. Quote, fight to protect the women that brought you to power or step aside and elect someone who will. The same group organized marches in 2020 and in 2017 after the election of President Trump. Rachel Sutherland on WMAL and WMAL.com.
Leaders from around the world expressing shock and grief over the assassination of Japan's former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Shinzo Abe was a voice for the political right who championed economic vitality and even a resumption of a Japanese military. He is remembered as a strong leader for his nation.
This is a very, very sad moment.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called Abe's killing horrifically disturbing. Israel's Prime Minister Yair Lapid called him a true friend of the Jewish state who made a visit to the Western Wall in 2015. The UAE's Sheikh Mohammed also called Abe a dear friend. China's government offered state condolence. Abe was fiercely critical of China's communist rulers. Eben Brown, Fox News.
Former President Trump taking time during a Las Vegas speech last night to talk about Abe.
Literally thousands of Americans are dead today because of the nationwide increase in murders since the left began its defund the police crusade. Democrat-run cities. The blood of these victims is almost exclusively in these Democrat strongholds.
And he also took time, as you just heard, to talk about the crime under the Biden administration. Trump tonight will hold a rally in Anchorage, Alaska. He's scheduled to speak at 8 o'clock Eastern. Sarah Palin is among the pre-rally speakers. Elon Musk planning to terminate his $44 billion plan to purchase Twitter.
Elon Musk's attorneys allege that Twitter's public disclosures regarding its number of daily active users are either false or materially misleading. They say Musk needs accurate information on this to engage in transition planning for the business. In an SEC filing Friday, they said, quote, Twitter has not complied with its contractual obligations. For nearly 2 months, Mr. Musk has sought the data and information necessary to make an independent assessment of the prevalence of fake or spam accounts on Twitter's platform. They go on to say Twitter has failed or refused to provide this information.
Fox's Christina Coleman. WMAL Sports, the Nats hoping to rally today after falling to the Braves 12-2 yesterday. First pitch in Atlanta set for just after 4 o'clock. The O's yesterday beating the Angels 5-4, and they're going to try to keep that going with weather permitting at 4:05 in Baltimore. WMAL Traffic and Weather next. WMAL Traffic and Weather. Here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In D.C. and Canal Road, both northbound and southbound lanes are blocked for a fallen tree between Whitehorse Freeway and Arizona Avenue. On 395 westbound in D.C., there is a crash reported after Main Avenue. Now into Virginia, on 395 southbound in Springfield, disabled vehicle with the right lane blocked approaching the Beltway. And on 66 in Falls Church, westbound, there is a crash with two right lanes blocked at the Dulles Connector Road. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Stormwatch 7 on weather alert for the remainder of the morning hours for pockets of moderate to heavy rain. We'll see localized flooding with a flood watch that remains in effect until early this afternoon. Temperatures will be in the 70s. Gradual clearing overnight with patchy fog by early tomorrow morning. Wake up temperatures in the 60s. Tomorrow, a beautiful end of the weekend. Lots of sunshine near 80 degrees. Middle 80s on Monday, mid 90s on Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
70 right now at Reagan National. I'm Maria Leaf on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Now on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday morning update.
Hour two of the Saturday morning update. Thanks for being with us this weekend. John Gizzi of the White House Correspondent, Chief Political Columnist at Newsmax.com. John, good morning.
Good morning.
Wasn't you that made off of those Norman Rockwells from the White House, was it?
No. I think that when the investigation comes about, they might look at someone else closer to the president that is interested in painting.
Well, it's been a chaotic week on the international political front, and I think probably the resignation of Boris Johnson is the really big story when it comes to the UK, Europe, and what it means for the relationship with the U.S. What happened? Why did he finally resign?
It had nothing to do with issues or ideology in any way, shape, or form. And remember, this is someone who has an 80-seat majority in the House of Commons, the powerful body that determines who runs the government. What brought Boris down was, well, Boris, as a member of Parliament, who actually had supported him once, told me, he lies when the truth will do.
Ooh.
He claimed that he did not know about parties going on at number 10 Downing Street in violation of regulations dealing with COVID that his own office laid out. Well, others said he was at the parties. It turned out that a man named Chris Pincher, charged with groping someone while drunk, that the Prime Minister was aware of the charges, that Pincher was indeed a pincher, and he nonetheless named him to his cabinet. He denied knowing about this. Then it was proven otherwise, and he said he forgot about it. The members had had enough, and more than 50 people from the cabinet level to the low level announced their resignation. And that's what brought Boris Johnson down after three tumultuous years at number 10 Downing Street.
So what's next in terms of leadership in the UK? What do they do now?
The Conservative Party will lay out its rules for selecting a new leader next week, and this could include any number of men and women who served in Boris Johnson's cabinet or outside the cabinet. They just have to be a member of the House of Commons. The rules that were applied last time when Boris Johnson won mean that the members of Parliament in the Conservative Party ballot until it is down to two names. Those two names are then submitted to the dues-paying member of the party for a U.S.-style primary for confirmation. The last three prime ministers, Boris Johnson, Theresa May, and David Cameron, were all selected in that manner. And the leader of the party thereupon becomes prime minister. The problem is, this doesn't happen overnight, and Boris Johnson is adamant that he stay on as prime minister until a new leader is selected. Others are saying, no way, go, but for the grace of God, go. And they want him to leave sooner rather than later. It's interesting that Boris Johnson's tenure as prime minister began in controversy and ends that way.
So what do the liberal and conservative movements in UK mean for the U.S.? When one of those groups gets power, what does it mean for us?
Well, one thing. The next prime minister from the Conservative Party will almost surely be, as Boris Johnson was, a supporter of Brexit, taking the United Kingdom out of the European Union. He will also continue the process by which Britain did get out of the EU, and this was mostly sculpted and executed by Boris Johnson. There's some things to carry on. So that means that the prime minister, the man with the special relationship with the American president, will be someone different from him. The Conservative Party is roughly equivalent to the Republican Party. Boris Johnson had an excellent relationship with President Trump, less so with President Biden. In fact, Joe Biden put out a statement not wishing Boris Johnson well, but wishing the UK well and hoping that they continue their relations with the US. So overall, it'll be someone like a more moderate Republican who will become leader in Britain, not close to Joe Biden, but not enough to cause any major ruptures between the two. And oh yes, carrying on as Boris Johnson did, the new prime minister will almost surely be an all-out supporter of Ukraine against Russia.
The former prime minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, was assassinated this week. And John, Japanese culture a little different than U.S. culture when it comes to gun violence. So how much of a shock was that to that country?
The entire nation not only is in mourning, but in total shock. Japan has among the strictest gun ownership laws in the world. As a matter of fact, there is no private ownership of guns, period. As a result, the number of murders committed by handguns since World War II is something like 18. Now, having said that, political assassination is rare in Japan, even when someone is not a leader. This is the first time anyone who has held the office of prime minister has been assassinated since the military took out the civilian prime minister back in 1932. The last time anything like this occurred was 1960, when Japanese Socialist Party leader Eiichiro Hashimura was stabbed during a debate with opponents and on live television as a teenager named Yamaguchi, who was radicalized into supporting nationalism and emperor worship, climbed on the stage and twice plunged a samurai sword into the politician. In other words, things like this don't happen. The incident I described was 62 years ago, and people still talk about it. There's a Pulitzer Prize-winning picture of it that's seen everywhere in Japan, and people know about this. So it is with Shinzo Abe. He was a friend of the United States, someone who presided over a more conservative brand of economics called Abenomics, and someone who very much sought to see the pacifist constitution of the post-war years amended into one that allowed the Japanese to defend themselves and defend any ships that go through the Sea of Japan. In other words, he was a politician of consequence who became Japan's longest-serving prime minister. He'll be missed.
The president is scrambling to try and keep his base intact for the November elections. Abortion is an issue that he is keying in on, and every time he mentions the word abortion, he mentions vote, vote, vote. He announced an executive order on Friday. What does that mean?
Not too much. The fact is, and the president has said he can't undo what the Supreme Court did and restore abortion nationwide. It's now been returned to the states after 50 years. Executive orders basically cover actions that occur on federal grounds and involving federal money. So here's what he's doing. He's directing the Secretary of Health and Human Services to submit a report to him within 30 days on what his department can do. He's going to make access to emergency contraception, in other words, using birth control pills or devices such as intrauterine devices, IUDs, to save the lives of pregnant mothers. That's it. He's ramping up education on the issue of abortion conducted by the Department of Health and Human Services, and he's convening legal organizations to launch nationwide legal fronts against the abortion decision. In the end, there's a lot in the executive order, but it doesn't really change what the Supreme Court ruling has done, sending the issue of abortion back to the states.
You know, lying to the FBI is a charge that is made, and sometimes you can get in really deep water for it, and sometimes you just get your wrist slapped or found not guilty. You've got a congressman in the news on that one.
Congressman Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska saw his career crash and burn, and he had to resign from Congress after he was found guilty of lying to the FBI about receiving money from a Lebanese billionaire. And there is so much to say about this case, I'll try to put it in a few short words. Congressman Fortenberry, through his attorney, insisted that he never knew that this money was being channeled through other individuals from the billionaire in question, who is already dealing with federal authorities on other cases of illegal money. I might add, he's one of the biggest contributors to the Clinton Foundation. In addition, someone who organized an event for the money was cooperating with the FBI, getting him on tape to agree to a meeting with agents. And the agents, in turn, caught the congressman at 8:30 in the evening at his home in Lincoln after he was out helping people with flash floods. He was exhausted. He was not sure exactly of what they were talking about. And there's all grounds to say that this is a case of created crime by the FBI. What did they say was a quid pro quo? A resolution condemning the murder of Christians in the Middle East by Islamic groups as genocide. This is something that passed the House unanimously and that the congressman introduced months before the money came in at the fundraising event. How it will turn out, I don't know. But a man's career has been destroyed. He's probably in debt from the legal costs. All he seeks on appeal is one thing, his good name.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. Keep up with him on Twitter, at John Gizzi. John, thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure, Rick. Stay cool this weekend, friends.
And dry. 20, it is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We got some follow-up questions for Jim Trusty next, but first, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Montgomery County, on the outer loop of the Beltway in Bethesda, flooding has the road blocked. Approaching Old Georgetown Road, you'll find three travel lanes and the right shoulder closed. On the VW Parkway northbound in Jessup, it's jammed up between 32 and the NSA. Southbound side of the VW Parkway in Fort Meade, that's jammed up between the NSA and 32. And in Springfield on 395 southbound, disabled vehicle has the right lane blocked approaching the Beltway. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Stormwatch 7 is on weather alert for the remainder of the morning hours. Areas of moderate to heavy rain, localized flooding with temperatures only in the 70s. Showers for this afternoon tapering off later on tonight with gradual clearing and patchy fog by early tomorrow morning. Temperatures will be in the 60s. Tomorrow, a beautiful day. Sunny skies for your Sunday. Temperatures near 80 degrees. We're trending warmer come early next week with highs in the 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
69 degrees in the nation's capital, 721, the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
As you know, Cheryl Atkinson is on hiatus in the summer. She is out producing shows for the fall for full measure. So we had a little extra time and wanted to get into another story with Jim Trusty. Of course, Jim is the partner at IFRA Law. He is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. I want to turn to a case that is gaining widespread national attention out of New York, and I want to read you a couple of paragraphs, and this is from the CBS News affiliate in New York. This is their wording, not mine. The case of a bodega clerk charged with murdering an ex-con who attacked him behind the counter is generating more controversy for the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg. A bipartisan group of city council members is demanding the case be dropped. Prosecutors may have to go to the videotape to see what's on it and what's not in deciding how to handle the hot potato case of bodega clerk Jose Alba, who fatally stabbed a man who went behind the counter to menace him. End of quote. What some of the legal pundits are saying, Jim, is this may all boil down to whether the clerk's decision to stab the perp was proportionate to the threat. The perp's girlfriend has a knife, and the perp is attacking the clerk. How do you gauge the proportionality of the threat in a case like that?
Yeah, with common sense. and common sense dictates that this man should not be spending another day in jail. I mean, keep in mind, they've charged him with second-degree murder, an intentional murder, and they have put him on a $250,000 bond. This is a state that doesn't seem to use bond very often. And he's spending his days in Rikers. This elderly gentleman is in probably one of the worst facilities that we have in this country. So this is an injustice in the making. Now, I think that the public has it right this time, and I'm always the one that says, let's slow down and look at the evidence and assess things. I think that still holds true here. You didn't have to initially arrest this man, charge him, and detain him. You could have spent some time actually looking at the video, interviewing witnesses, reviewing the criminal record of the deceased, which is apparently substantial and violent. All of those are legitimate factors for deciding whether to charge or not. And I will say this, your best case scenario as a prosecutor in this fact pattern is at best an involuntary manslaughter, which is a serious crime, but the basis of it is that Mr. Alba held a sincere and honest belief that he needed to defend himself, but it was unreasonable objectively. In other words, the jury didn't think that it was proportional, as you said. I don't think that's a likely outcome here. I think that when you talk about having a young man come at you in a, what, 2-foot by 5-foot chamber with a girlfriend nearby with a knife, and the young man is not just accosting you, he's shoving you into the wall and threatening you, and punching at you, you know, you don't have to wait. Like, I think the fallacy here is people don't move like chess pieces. Mr. Alba was not in a position where he has to sit there and wait and say, I wonder if he's going to get the knife from his girlfriend, or I wonder if he's going to hit me with something, or I wonder why he keeps reaching to the back of his pants. Does he have a weapon? That's not reasonable. That's not real life. And I think a real prosecutor looking at this case very quickly would be able to determine, number one, that murder is not appropriate under any circumstance. That's an overcharge. And number two, that even the manslaughter theory is spectacularly weak. Two quick things on that, Rick. One is there's a real good chance that a jury in this case would hear about any criminal record of the deceased. And that kind of makes it easy for a lot of people if they hear that he's done time as a robber and committed other acts of violence. The other thing is, you know, prosecutors sometimes try to get away with this overcharge because it gets them a plea. So you get this guy locked up in Rikers, you charge him with draconian second-degree murder, and then you hope that he's willing to take a manslaughter plea just to get out of Rikers. I honestly think that might be going on here, and I sure hope it isn't, and I sure hope it doesn't end that way. I hope that you get lawyers that, you know, blast through this inertia of the district attorney's office and say, get this man out, and if you want to go to trial, let's go. Because I think they've got a very winnable case. So it's going to be interesting to see if the pressure gets to Mr. Bragg, but this is legitimate pressure. This is an injustice in the making.
When we hear the word SARS, it brings back memories back in the early part of the new millennium when there was a respiratory illness that was threatening the world. Now we're hearing of SARS in relation to Hunter Biden, but I don't think it's the same SARS.
No, but Hunter Biden might be a little short of breath from these SARS, actually, so who knows? Yeah, what we're talking about are suspicious activity reports. And in the old days, Rick, you know, when the Bank Secrecy Act was passed in 1970, the idea of suspicious activity reports, or SARS, was that if there was something unusual about a transaction, usually tied to a particular dollar amount, that the bank had an obligation to let people at Treasury know. And specifically, there's a group at Treasury called the Financial Crime Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. They're like the repository of these SARS. I always had this vision that it was like the bank teller at the drive-thru that looks at me and says, how do you have this kind of money? You know, and that I get in trouble with Treasury because of that. But in today's world, it's much more mechanized. It's all about algorithms. And the banks take this responsibility very seriously, and they're very sophisticated in their approach. And in fact, they probably report more than they have to. They have to report certain things as suspicious, but they have discretion. So if you have a person that makes, 15 deposits in 2 days for $9,999, that's either a really lucky person or somebody that's trying to hide their income. And so they have the discretion to report things that don't necessarily technically meet the requirements. With Hunter, we may have a new record. We have apparently 150 SARS that have been generated about transactions he's involved in. And the best way to think of these SARs is really strong leads for prosecutors doing a financial investigation. It's not the end all. It's not the total evidence. It's kind of the skeleton for the body that tells you where to find everything else to flesh it out. So if I have a SARS report that shows a wire transfer to a shell company owned by Hunter Biden from some Russian oligarch's wife for $2 million, well, that's a huge clue to start with, obviously. But what you're going to do is follow up with subpoenas, with interviews, and figure out, okay, what was the transaction? What service was supposedly being gained by this Russian oligarch? And where did the money, most importantly, maybe, when $2 million came into the shell account, where did it go and when? So if you start seeing 10% going to the big guy, or if you start seeing personal and commingled accounts getting a lot of this money for very questionable services rendered, then you can build a case for all sorts of potential federal violations, money laundering, Foreign Agent Registration Act, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, honest services fraud as a wire fraud basis. There's a lot in play, and it starts a lot of times with these SARs.
Jim Trusty, thank you so much for the details. Partner at IFRA Law, and you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
And you too. We've got the 7:30 news coming up with Maria Leaf. We're back with Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning. I'm Maria Lee. Former Trump White House counsel Pat Cipollone had an eight-hour private interview with the January 6th committee, and one committee member says he did not contradict earlier witness testimony. It is expected that we will get to see some of that closed-door testimony during hearings scheduled for next week. The committee has a hearing planned for Tuesday morning, and there are also reports there will be another primetime hearing scheduled for Thursday. Two parents in custody after their nine-month-old baby somehow ingested fentanyl.
According to the DEA, it only takes a tiny amount of fentanyl to kill you, just 2 milligrams. It's often added to cocaine, Adderall, and Xanax. That's what admittedly happened to Alexis Burnett and her boyfriend, Sage Freeze, who told Jacksonville, Florida investigators that he had crushed and snorted Xanax the night before, which had been mixed with fentanyl. Somehow that got into the body of their nine-month-old baby girl, who had to be rushed to a children's hospital after she stopped breathing and her lips turned blue. A urine test of both parents also revealed fentanyl in their systems. The baby survived.
Fox's Phil Keating. WMAL Sports, the Nats hoping to rally. They fell to the Braves 12-2 yesterday. First pitch in Atlanta after 4 o'clock today. The O's beat the Angels 5-4. They're going to play around the same time this afternoon. WMAL Traffic and Weather next. WMAL Traffic and Weather, LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On the Claire Barton Parkway westbound, there is a crash at MacArthur Boulevard. On the outer loop of the Beltway in Montgomery County in Bethesda, flooding has 3 travel lanes in the right shoulder blocked approaching Old Georgetown Road. Traffic is jammed from Rockville Pike. In Virginia, 95 northbound at Garrisonville, there is a crash. 2 left lanes are blocked at 610. And on the southbound side of 95 in Dale City, that's jammed up between Dale Boulevard and the Truckway Station. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Stormwatch 7 on weather alert for the remainder of the morning hours for pockets of moderate to heavy rain. We'll see localized flooding with a flood watch that remains in effect until early this afternoon. Temperatures will be in the 70s. Gradual clearing overnight with patchy fog by early tomorrow morning. Wake up temperatures in the 60s. Tomorrow, a beautiful end of the weekend. Lots of sunshine near 80 degrees. Middle 80s on Monday, mid-90s on Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
71 right now at Reagan National. I'm Maria Leaf on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
It's the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the host of the Thought to Action podcast. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart and also the president of the London Center for Policy Research. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to be here.
On Wednesday, Reuters, the reputable news agency, revealing that more than 5 million barrels of oil from the nation's strategic petroleum reserves were sent overseas as part of President Biden's latest release, initiated in March. I'm sure that helped you and I out at the pump, as well as anyone listening this morning.
Oh, yeah.
There was a follow-up headline at The Federalist. Biden sold oil from emergency reserves to Chinese gas giant tied to his scandal-plagued son. Tell us the story here, Tony.
So basically, there's two sides that are out there playing out. The side that I'm tending to believe is the one the Chinese are backing, believe it or not. Basically, a company that Hunter Biden and his firm had invested in was one of the beneficiaries of this release. And what's significant here is that this release, which was supposed to go essentially to U.S. domestic sources for purposes of lowering U.S. prices, not global prices, ended up in the hands of Sinopec, which is a Chinese company that obviously deals in petroleum. And the link of Hunter Biden has not been denied. What they're saying is Hunter Biden no longer has an interest in it, while the Chinese are saying, no, he's still listed as one of the owners. And it's one of those things that, first off, you would think, Rick, the administration would be trying to even avoid the appearance of being compromised. They're not. And secondly, this does, to me, rise to the level of, I'm sorry, I'm just going to say impeachment. The American people are in the middle of a crisis created by the economic policies of this administration, after those policies have the effect that we've all observed, massive hikes in energy prices, they go and sell nearly a million barrels of oil to a country which is working to undermine our economy. We're talking about through their low price selling stuff, fentanyl being manufacturing center, all these things. And the reason it's happening, I believe, is because it goes back to Tony Bobulinski, who was the whistleblower, came forward and talked about Hunter Biden setting aside 10% for the big guy, which I do believe is Joe Biden. So again, Rick, this is not being disputed by the White House. It's just they're saying, well, we had to sell it to the global market, which is not true. The U.S. government can decide whoever it wants to sell it to. That's an excuse that is not actually supported by the facts available. And secondly, they sold it to a company that Hunter Biden literally, by some accounts, still has stakeholdings, you know, as a stakeholder in. So there's just no getting around how bad this looks. And if it looks bad, it is bad, and it has to be investigated. So this is something that there's absolutely no excuse, no logical excuse for, except for corruption.
I want to turn to the horrific shooting in Highland Park, Illinois. Bobby Cremo, the 21-year-old charged with killing 7 in that mass shooting, had threatened to kill everyone in his home with a collection of knives 3 years before that. Law enforcement had gone to the home, found he had 16 knives, a dagger, and a sword. They came back a second time, called to a report from a family member that Cremo had vowed to kill the people inside the home, and he had that trove of knives. There were postings on social media, and I happened to be watching television at the time the shooting took place, and when they announced that he was the suspect, I went right to his Facebook page, and it linked you to YouTube before YouTube, like hours later, pulled it down. And there were obviously violent videos on YouTube, and nobody caught that. So law enforcement goes to the home. He's threatening to kill people. He's got, 18 weapons, the knives and sword and dagger. How did they miss this when there's so much attention on this type of thing now, and nobody's connecting the dots?
See, this is where some departments are. You know, I advise Sheriff Dave Decatur down in Stafford County as Homeland Security Advisor. I don't want to go into how they do business, but I'm very impressed with the methodology they use to maintain an understanding of what's going on within their county. And I'd like to believe that they would have picked up on something like this and had it on their radar. And as a matter of fact, not only had on their radar, but were prepared to do something to stop it. And in this case, Rick, I think the folks who were monitoring Cremo, they did see this. As a matter of fact, part of the issue right now is they're looking at charging his dad, Robert Cremo, by the fact that despite all of this nonsense, he sponsored his son to get a gun license. So clearly there's something else going on here, because the father then worked to twice support his son getting these weapons he got, because obviously, as you point out, there were there was responses to activities which I consider criminal. I think you would too. And then all of these things online. The police saw that, Rick. They saw that. I mean, this publicly available. They would have went and looked, at least if they had a good intelligence session looking at this, and they would have made an assessment of threat. They would have been prepared to do something. That's
even
where it
the
all
background
breaks down.
Check, Tony. Why doesn't this stuff come up on a background check when the guy goes out to buy the guns?
Well, that's a great question, and that's the answer is it's all federal. The state in Illinois.
Illinois, north of Chicago,
goes to the federal database. And what happens here is that the database does not contain local information for the most part. So they do the check, unless something is put into a criminal database somewhere. And something like this wouldn't have risen to the level of a formal charge and conviction. Therefore, it would have not likely been included in that database. So that's why it didn't come up. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm saying it didn't come up, obviously. And then the dad coming in and kind of sponsoring it had a secondary effect of pushing it through. So I think that's something clearly we have to look at, is how that happened. But again, this is not the first time this happened. Every other mass shooting that's on the radar right now, there has been some indication that the individual who committed those horrific crimes were already on the radar in some form. These people were known to law enforcement in some form, and yet they were either able to legally get a firearm, or nobody worked to intercede and get them into treatment or observation for what clearly was mental illness that resulted in all these crimes.
And we got about 2 minutes left. Wanted to get your read on the investigation results were released by Customs and Border Protection. Remember the images that were so dramatized by the president, the vice president, and the Secretary of Homeland Security saying that Border Patrol agents struck Haitian migrants with their reins and used them as whips and strapped them back in September. Well, 10 months later, the investigation is complete. The head of CBP said there was no evidence Border Patrol struck them. There were some minor violations of protocol violations. They had to come up with something, I guess, to stick them with something.
Right.
After 10 months, you got to find something to hang on them.
What is
your thought on all of that?
Well, like you said, I mean, in an investigation of that level, you don't start an investigation like that without trying to place some blame somewhere, and that's what they did, and it's horrific that they even did that. No, trust me, I've been on both ends of these sorts of things. Trust me, I know how it works. And the bottom line is, those charges should never have been brought. It's sad and amazing that Biden and others went out and trashed these agents who were simply trying to do their job. Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, said that the morale is all-time low. This is why. This is one of the reasons why. You cannot have a government which actually requires people to go out and do their duty, and the moment they do their duty, you call into question the manner in which they conducted it, even though now, after the fact, it proves they were doing everything completely by the book. And this is one of those things where the Biden administration is horrific, and it's not going to get any better from here. So,
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, host of the Thought to Action podcast. Somebody has some time on their hands in the summertime. What would they hear this weekend?
Well, we've been going through a lot of the gun policies that we're talking about, the new laws, as well as we did the people have Ask Us Anything, where we go through a spectrum of different national security issues, which people will get a real good education on the current issues that we're facing. So, thank Rick. Always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. LondonCenter.org for the podcast. We're at 746 LBDs in the WML Traffic Center this morning.
In D.C., Canal Road, both northbound and southbound lanes are blocked for a fallen tree between Whitehorse Freeway and Arizona Avenue. On the Clara Barton Parkway westbound, there is a crash right at MacArthur Boulevard. On the Beltway in Bethesda, Outer Loop, there's flooding. Approaching Old Georgetown Road, three travel lanes are blocked. Traffic is jammed from Rockville Pike. And on southbound 95 in Virginia, it's jammed up in Dale City between Dale Boulevard and the Truckway Station. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Stormwatch 7 is on weather alert for the remainder of the morning hours. Areas of moderate to heavy rain, localized flooding with temperatures only in the 70s. Showers for this afternoon tapering off later on tonight with gradual clearing and patchy fog by early tomorrow morning. Temperatures will be in the 60s. Tomorrow, a beautiful day. Sunny skies for your Sunday. Temperatures near 80 degrees. We're trending warmer come early next week with highs in the 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Currently 69 degrees in the nation's capital, 747. Saturday morning update. KT McFarland coming up next. 7:50, this is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. KT McFarland joins us. President Trump's Deputy National Security Advisor. She is a board member of the American Conservative Union and the author of the best-selling book, Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, honored to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure and an honor for me too, Rick.
Well, thank you. And you look at the world, and you were at the White House, and you've had a career in looking at global politics, global dynamics. And when we look at Ukraine, the war there, we look at the shortages, food, gasoline, we look at inflation. You have the assassination of the former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe yesterday, Boris Johnson resigning this week. Put it in perspective as we look at the globe. It seems like everything is just up in the air.
That's a very good way of saying it. I think everything is up in the air. And it's a very disquieting period. I mean, if we look domestically, right, as you started out by talking about, we have massive inflation. We have an economy where there's a lot of people don't want to work or don't have jobs, and yet at the same time there are a lot of jobs going begging. So that seems out of whack. Housing prices are going through the roof, and yet so people aren't buying houses. I mean, it's just everything is out of whack, and the American people, both sides of the political aisle, are really angry. And they're angry a couple of times a day, right? They're angry when they check out at the grocery store. They're angry when they go fill up their tank of gas. They're just increasingly angry about everything because just a year ago things were pretty good, and now today things don't seem very well at all, and they don't really look to a White House that's even acknowledging their problems. So we're in for a real sea change domestically in the United States. If you look abroad, a lot of countries are experiencing the same thing we are. It's the massive inflation. A lot of it is driven by Biden's war on American fossil fuels. Because we're not producing the fossil fuels we have the ability to do, it means other countries will. There's a shortage globally. Prices go up, simple supply demand. But other countries in Europe are feeling the same thing we are, especially if you look at Britain. They have massive inflation. And then look at the sort of foreign policy part of the world. You know, Britain is our closest ally. Britain has left the European Union under Boris Johnson. That was his singular achievement. And yet, it hasn't really gelled yet. It hasn't settled. Britain hasn't really sorted through all the issues, neither has the rest of Europe. And now with Boris Johnson gone, it's not clear, is the new guy or woman, are they going to follow those policies of independence of the European Union and then a closer relationship to the United States? Not clear. Same on Japan. Japan is our closest ally in Asia. And Shinzo Abe, although he is a former prime minister, his shadow looms large because the countries of the Asian Pacific region have looked to Abe and looked to Japan as the leader in trying to form not an anti-China coalition, but a protection against China coalition. Will his successors continue that with Abe's sort of strong influence gone from the scene? So it's like every major issue, if you look around the world, there's uncertainty everywhere. The only certainty is that nobody likes the governments they have.
That's very true. What might happen in Russia? I mean, you know, we talk about the chaos, and there have been these reports that Vladimir Putin is very ill. If he were to go out of power, what would that dynamic mean? We could get somebody that's even more evil than Putin, or maybe you get somebody that's a little more normal.
Well, you have that in both cases. I mean, in the Chinese case, China's having economic difficulties of his own. And will the Chinese president, in his fall meetings, where he's kind of, you know, the Chinese leaders from all over the country get together at their annual conference, and they decide who's going to be the new leader, and will they do what Xi Jinping wants? Will they give him, kind of designate him as leader for life, more or less? And the Russians are going through the same thing. There's, you know, there clearly are issues at home in Russia, but will Putin continue to sort of plow through it? I think in both cases, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are probably in a much better political position than, say, Boris Johnson, Joe Biden, or Donald Trump. I think they're far more likely, even with domestic opposition, to sort of muscle their way through this. But when you look at the United States' political horizon, so what's happening? You know, no, if the Democrats are running away from Biden as fast as they can. They're saying he shouldn't run. I mean, they're quietly saying it. They're not yet publicly announcing it. But they're quietly saying no Biden, no Kamala Harris, and frankly, no far-left-wing Democrats, because even the most of the sort of person who embodies the far-left, anti-American, progressive wing of the Democrat Party, a Michigan congressman, Ilhan Omar, she was booed off the stage last week at a concert. She went to a concert in her district, and there were 10,000 of her supposed supporters in the stands, and they booed her off the stage. So, again, the people who thought that they were going to have the levers of power, I think they probably don't understand it themselves, but they're about to be exited from the stage, whether it's, you know, the 80-year-old Nancy Pelosi, the 80-year-old Chuck Schumer, the 80-year-old Joe Biden, the 80-year-old Donald Trump. They're all of a certain generation, and whether they're in their late 70s or early 80s, they're pretty much older than the rest of the population that they tend to represent. So I think what the country is looking for is a rematch, not a rematch of Biden and Trump, but a rematch of the younger version of them, which is, say, Gavin Newsom of California. He's clearly running for president on the left progressive wing, and maybe a Ron DeSantis, who is a lot of Trump's own policies, except without Trump's personality. And you know, the Republicans in the country seem to like Trump's policies. They just didn't like the tweets. They didn't like the divisiveness. But if you're going to run for president in 2024, it's a really simple question, whether you're Donald Trump or DeSantis or Pompeo or all the Republicans and the terrific bench the Republicans have. It's one simple question. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And there's nobody in the United States who's going to answer yes. Maybe a couple of people from the Biden West Wing. But otherwise, nobody in the country thinks we're better off. So, you know, hang on to your seats. Hang on to your hat and buckle up your seatbelt, because we're about to have a really rocky two-year period.
KT McFarland, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. And something, we don't have time to do it this morning, but this kind of leads to a discussion in your role as a board member of the American Conservative Union. You're obviously involved in CPAC. You see the youth at CPAC. Right now, we see President Biden trying to rally the youth around the country on the abortion issue. And every time he says abortion, it's followed by vote, vote, vote. So maybe next week or the next couple of weeks, we can talk about the messaging for November for the conservative movement. How do you address the conservative youth in this country, motivate them to get out to the polls when you have all this Democratic fundraising and all this messaging to try and ratchet up the Democratic base, which right now is more concerned basically with inflation and the other problems than some of the environmental issues and things like that. So when we have some time, I'd like to air that out with you.
You got a date.
Perfect. KT McFarland, thank you so much.
Thank you.
7:59, and that's it for the Saturday Morning Update. Garden Sense follows the 8 o'clock news with Maria Leaf.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.